ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Fran Kelly, and this is the Radio National Hour, coming to you from the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation in Sydney. Coming up, as the Christian Brothers cry poor and appeal to the court for a stay on compensation payments to victims of historical child sexual abuse, attention is turning to the properties they transferred to Edmund Rice Education Australia for as little as $1. Also ahead, are your meds doing you more harm than good? Australia launches a world-first de-prescribing program to help people. Too many of us are just using sleeping tablets and opioids for too long, with serious medical implications. And 80 years ago today, the USA detonated an atomic bomb over Bikini Atoll in the Marshall Islands, the beginnings of a devastating nuclear testing program in the Pacific.
For 12 long years, the U.S. have done that. They did 67 nuclear tests on Bikini Atoll and Niuetuk. One of those tests called Castle Bravo was so strong that they said it's 1,000 times stronger than the ones used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
For those who lived in the shadows of this deadly experiment, the fallout continues. Tomorrow, lawyers for the Christian Brothers will be back in court to renew their bid for a permanent stay on more than 200 sexual abuse claims so that they can get their dwindling finances in order and permanently wind up the Catholic lay order. They say they're broke after paying out more than $570 million in compensation payments. You might have heard my interview last week with lawyer Judy Courton. Judy represents dozens of clergy abuse victims. And she, like many, is deeply cynical about the Christian Brothers' claims of empty coffers. She explained that the brothers have transferred their extensive portfolio of assets over many years to a spin-off entity, Edmund Rice Education Australia.
There was an organisation called Edmund Rice Education Australia, mm-hmm. was commenced in 2007. Between roughly 2013 and 2024, the Christian Brothers basically did these transfers of property to EREA, Edmund mm-hmm. Rice, for a dollar.
Well, to help us understand the assets that were held by the Christian Brothers and the manner in which they were divested, I'm joined by Dean Patch, the Director of Ownership Matters, which is a corporate governance advisory company. Dean, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Thanks, Fran.
Dean, you've been at the heart of these tragic and ongoing efforts to hold the Christian Brothers to account for decades, but you're not acting here in any official capacity, are you? Just explain how this became something of a crusade for you.
A number of my friends at high school were the subject of cover-ups by the Christian Brothers at the Christian Brothers High School that I went to. And as they entered late adulthood, I was one of a number of people who got together to help them pursue both their criminal and civil rights. And as someone who works in the finance industry, I've taken a very keen interest in the Christian Brothers' ability to pay, but also I had a bird's eye view about what terrible litigants they are and just how much pain they put into my friends. And so I've always taken an interest, and I expected this day would come at some point. And so, yes, I'm very happy to explain their accounting chicanery.
You went to school in Trinity College in Colac, and you've been pursuing, or your pursuit was of a teacher, but a predator by the name of Kevin Wilmore Myers. This history is well documented. He preyed, as you said, upon your mates. How extensive was his predation and his abuse of young students?
This man worked for the Christian Brothers from 1968 right through to the end of the 70s. And when, in the course of the civil action, we were able to uncover that he was first molesting children with the knowledge of the Christian Brothers as far back as 1968. His final offences took place in the 80s. The key thing here is that this happened with the knowledge and enabling of the Christian Brothers organisation. So it was shocking to actually find out that, you know, people who otherwise present as respectable people in your local community were actually enabling criminal behaviour of this magnitude, and to see that the lifelong effects on people that, you know, I knew as friends is, you know, it's quite impactful. But, you know, the real heroes of the story are the people that got together to denounce the crimes that happened. But once that occurred in the start of 2020, that's when another battle began, and where a number of my old friends took civil action against the Christian Brothers. And that took years to resolve. Even though the case was open and shut, they took every legal tactic, every delaying principle they possibly could, with no regard whatsoever at the cost to the victim survivors.
Let's come to the story now, the more recent history and the money trail that's critical to the ongoing action that's currently in the courts, because, as you say, corporate governance, finance, money trails, it's your bread and butter. As we heard here on the program last week, the Christian Brothers established Edmund Rice Education Australia in 2007 with the intention, and I'm quoting, of independently implementing the educational mission of the Christian Brothers. Now, lawyer Judy Courton told us last week that they started transferring their assets to this entity, EREA, from 2013. These were mostly properties, as I understand it. Can you tell us a bit about what they transferred and what they're worth?
So in 2013, they commenced a process to transfer the land and buildings on which the Christian Brothers schools were operated on. They transferred, on their numbers, about $85 million out, but that was at an ancient historical cost. It didn't reflect the actual value of the land and buildings at the time. When you look at the accounts of the what's called the trustees of the Edmund Rice Education Australia, they brought on the first tranche of properties at $352 million, but there were five subsequent years of transfers, such that at the values back then, 2013 through to 2017, they transferred $891 million. Those assets today, if I just apply, you know, a minimum return, are worth more than $2 billion. Those transfers took place without any payment. So there's $2 billion worth of assets transferred from the Christian Brothers, which is the organisation that hitherto has been sued by survivors, into the hands of the trustees of Edmund Rice Education Australia.
And you say, as I understand it, that this transfer had papal approval. Can you tell me more about that and the significance of that?
Well, the transfer took place after the body that was set up received papal approval and was given corporate status under an obscure law in New South Wales.
That's the EREA, the Edmund Rice Education Australia.
Yeah, it's the trustees of the Edmund Rice Education Australia. There are two distinct entities. It gets all a bit arcane. But yes, it was only after that organisation had been set up. But the key thing is that that is an associated trust of the Christian Brothers, and the control that was was exercised by the Christian Brothers over that organisation was absolute.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. Dean Patch is my guest. He's a corporate governance advisor who, as you can tell, over the years in his spare time has spent a long time following the money trial of the Christian Brothers and Edmund Rice Education Australia, which is the entity that runs many of what were the Christian Brothers schools across Australia. Dean, this transfer of property was happening during the time of the Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Abuse, which ran from 2013 to 2017. Is there any proof that this was done with the express purpose of protecting the Christian Brothers from plaintiffs?
No. There is plausible deniability in the sense that they were setting up this organisation to transfer the assets to enable the continuity of the education arm of the brothers. Mm-hmm. A happy accident, though, is that it was in a separate legal entity. And so bear in mind that the final transfers took place in 2017, the claims post-Royal Commissions after the demise of the Ellis defence started rising in 2018 onwards. So in the 5 years post-Royal Commission, post the transfer of these assets, the Christian Brothers were paying out at least they paid out $130 million in 2018. They've paid out $571 million in total. The vast bulk of that occurred after these assets were transferred.
Judy Courtin was adamant when she spoke to us last week that this was the intention of the Christian Brothers, to divest themselves of these assets so that they would not be able to basically or have to pay out claims from plaintiffs. You've been digging into the financial and organisational structures that bind the Christian Brothers and the EREA, and you recently submitted an FOI request for information about the trustees. What was it that you discovered?
Well, the trustees of the Edmund Rice Education Australia were all appointed by the Christian Brothers right up until 2020. They had control of the membership, they had control of the board, they had control of the constitution. They even had the ability within that constitution to pay Christian Brothers. The control was absolute. They sanitised the constitution in 2021. To make their influence less obvious. But it's a happy accident that during the period in which all of these transfers were going on, they were in complete and utter control of the entity they set up to receive them. This is a little akin to James Hardy. So when James Hardy sought to leave the victims of asbestos poisoning high and dry, they did what was called the Texas two-step. They transferred the liabilities out to another organisation with insufficient assets, and they left it swinging high and dry. Here, what they've done is they've transferred the assets out but kept the liabilities back in the trustees of the Christian Brothers, although that scheme now seems to be unravelling, which is a good thing.
Okay, but both the entities, both the Christian Brothers and the Edmund Rice Education Australia, have been pressed on this, the connection, if you like, between them and if one is liable for the other, since this has blown up in public. And both say, let me read you the statement from the EREA, the Christian Brothers Oceania province plays no role in the governance, ownership, management responsibilities or operation of any of our schools. Historical sexual abuse claims against the Christian Brothers prior to 2007 are exclusively handled by Christian Brothers Oceania province. Edmund Rice Education Australia has taken responsibility for any claims made after 2007. So they're adamant, and presumably this is what they'll be arguing in the court, that they have no link and therefore no liability.
Well, that's not what their constitution that was released yesterday under FOI says. Right up until 2021, it was absolutely clear that there was constitutional control exercised by the Christian Brothers over the trustees of Edmund Rice Education Australia. But ultimately, that will be for the court to determine. What is clear is that post-Royal Commission, new defendants can be substituted, even though the Christian Brothers cannot meet those claims. Where there is an associated trust, and it's clear that the trustees of EREA are an associated trust and there is sufficient assets there to meet future claims. So this will be the subject of litigation, and I'm sure that those venerable schools, St. Kevin's in Melbourne, many others, will be resisting putting their land for the payment of victims.
So you mentioned earlier the Ellis defence, how the church had been relying on that up until the time of the Royal Commission, and it was a legal loophole, really, that relied on the notion that church was an unincorporated organisation, therefore not a legal entity. The Royal Commission effectively ended that. Well, explain why that's critical to this current situation, and is that where there's an associated trust comes into it?
Yeah, that's right. So what the legislation that was brought in post-Royal Commission said is that you can't do the James Hardy Texas two-step. You can't send your liabilities or your assets off to an associated trust and continue to control it, but rely on a legal fiction that you have no money. So those steps that are taken, it's called the identification of proper defendants, are now the subject of legal claims. So interestingly, the court action that's taking place tomorrow, it's clear that anyone who has an action can still continue to pursue proper defendants, which include any associated trusts.
You're listening to Radio National Hour. My guest is corporate governance advisor Dean Patch. We're talking about the Christian Brother claims that they're broke, that the order is going to close down because they cannot meet their commitments to those people who are seeking compensation from the Christian Brothers for past sexual abuse claims, and there are many, many hundreds of them. So the Christian Brothers will be back in court tomorrow, Dean, arguing for this moratorium on all civil claims. Could the court reject that and demand that they name a successor? Is that in their power?
Well, I think there's an agreement that the orders that will be made do not extend to preventing someone naming a new defendant. So what's being sought is a moratorium against any new claims against the Christian Brothers, and that there be no collections on any of the judgments or settlements that have been agreed. But anyone who is pursuing claims can nominate that this other organisation, the Associated Trusts, the trustees of the Edmund Rice Education Australia, can be the defendant. And bear in mind, these guys are absolutely flush with cash. On my numbers, they have $3.4 billion in net assets. Each year for the last 5 years, they've made $160 million in operating cash flow. That's $160 million each year that is left in the till. They spend it on new buildings and wellness centres and sports facilities. But the point is that they have very little debt. They have absolutely prized assets. They could easily, out of their operating cash flow, meet all of the ongoing commitments of the Christian Brothers where they're found to be an associated trust.
Okay, but the Christian Brothers have said on their website, they've got a whole question and answer area, and they say if the proposed scheme does not receive the necessary level of creditor support or approval of the court, and that's happening tomorrow, then the province entities will have no option but to enter liquidation. Now, liquidation would presumably be catastrophic for any claimants, past and future. So that's what the Christian Brothers are saying will happen. What's to stop that from happening? Is it all dependent on the interpretation of the Royal Commission finding that you're just talking about?
Yeah. So anyone who has a current claim or a future claim can apply to the court, or it can rely on the Christian Brothers nominating their associated trusts as appropriate defendants.
Which they haven't done.
They haven't done as yet, but there are applications in Victoria that are on foot right now that the Victorian Supreme Court to decide that.
I should say, though, that the Christian Brothers have said in a statement prior that they had asked both EREA and the Catholic Church for financial assistance, which had not been forthcoming.
That's correct. But the post-Royal Commission reforms very carefully set out the ability for you to nominate associated trusts. It doesn't matter what someone believes or says. It's what the law actually applies. So I'm sure this will be the subject of litigation because people have a lot to lose. But the question here is, what's the right thing to do? The Christian Brothers have given away $2 billion worth of assets to someone who hasn't paid a dime for them. Surely they can reach in their pocket and make good the sins of that order.
So let's talk about what's the right thing to do for the Catholic Church or for the schools run by Edmund Rice Education Australia, and also the individuals and the families who benefit from the schools or the wellness centres or the sports facilities, as you say, the parents who send their kids to these schools. Do you think they should be feeling and exerting any moral pressure here?
Well, yeah, it's up to them. I mean, look at what happened with James Hardie. So the ultimate settlement for James Hardie, the victims of the asbestos poisoning were not left swinging by James Hardie. In the end, what was decided was that 25% of the ongoing earnings of James Hardie would be put in a pot to meet the claims of future victims. The same sort of arrangement could come to pass with ERA. ERA can easily borrow and spread the cost of these claims over a 10, 20, 30 years with no impact on these parents. These parents would be paying no more than a cup of coffee a day in order to fully meet the liabilities of the Christian Brothers. And bear in mind, it's not like James Hardie, where there is intergenerational claims. Many of the men who have been subject to the Christian Brothers' abuse over time are elderly. They're dying as well. And it's not like there are multiple generations as well. This is a finite liability. Let's say there's $1 billion worth of potential claims for the Christian Brothers. ERA has $3.4 billion in net assets. It could easily borrow and spread the pain so that the parents and students, frankly, of these Christian Brothers schools that have been enjoying the benefit of, you know, what's effectively a disposal of assets that should go to meet the liability for the crimes of the brothers, they could easily borrow and meet those claims with no impact whatsoever on ERA.
Dean, thank you very much for joining us.
You're most welcome, friend.
Dean Patch is the director of Ownership Matters, a corporate governance advisory company. And just a reminder that the Oceania province of the Christian Brothers are back in court tomorrow, requesting that permanent stay on court proceedings and payouts. You're listening to the Radio National Hour.
Coming up on Big Ideas with Natasha Mitchell.
Hey, do you feel like a joyful winter listen away from hardcore headlines? Hell yeah, I hear you say. Astrid Jorgensen, she's the founder and host of what's been called the world's biggest one-night stand in song. It's called Pub Choir. But she could have become a nun, and you can hear why and how. It's a great yarn. Astrid joins me today.
Big Ideas, tonight from 8 on ABC Radio National.
The Radio National Hour with Fran Kelly.
Dealing with persistent and chronic pain can be debilitating and exhausting. But studies have also found that the drugs prescribed to help people with the symptoms can cause more problems than they solve. That's why Monash University in Melbourne has launched the world's first de-prescribing program. As experts warn that chronic reliance on some medications is leading to severe and dangerous side effects and causing increased patient harm. This new program is called Support Meds, and its aim is to help participants give up on sleeping pills and reduce their reliance on some opioids for chronic pain that's unrelated to cancer. Associate Professor Emily Reeve is at the Centre for Medicine Use and Safety at the Monash Institute of Pharmaceutical Sciences, and she's the lead in this new program. And I'm also joined by Dr. Adil Aziz, a Victorian GP and Deputy Chair of the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners. Emily and Adil, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Emily, let's start with the basic. Why do we need a de-prescription program, and what prescriptions are you focusing on?
Yeah, so we know that too many Australians, particularly older Australians, are taking medicines that may not be helping them anymore or are actively harming them. It's about 2 million people in Australia on five or more medicines. De-prescribing.
Can I just stop you there? That's a staggering statistic, isn't it?
It is. It absolutely is. And we know that when we look at that older adult population, the numbers are even higher. And when we get into what medications they're taking, in the older adult population, up to 80% of older adults are on one or more medications where those harms outweigh the benefits.
And so what sort of medications are we talking about? Spell it out for everyone, can you?
Yeah, so there are a variety of medications, and really in an individual, any medication could be right or wrong for them. However, there are a number of high-risk medications or medications we know that are used for longer than necessary. The first two medication classes that we're starting with that are a focus of this program are sleeping medicines, particularly these medications we call benzodiazepines and Z-drugs. And then, as you mentioned before, opioids when they're used long-term for persistent non-cancer pain.
And can you give some brand names that people might recognise here?
Yeah, so with the sleeping tablets, it's ones like people might have heard of Temazepam, which is a brand name of Temaze, or one of the Z-drugs is Zolpidem or Stilnox. For the opioids, there's a variety of different ones like oxycodone, morphine, codeine, tramadol, and they come with a variety of different brand names like Endone or Tramil. Or for the codeine, it is what you also see used in combination with like Panadol or Nurofen. Those kind of plus ones have that codeine in it.
And what is the danger you're addressing here? Is it addiction or is it chronic over-reliance, and is that different to addiction?
Well, so it is quite a complex issue, but one of the main things is, in fact, that these medications, when used long-term, actually don't provide a benefit in most people. And so there is a tolerance to the medication, and then, as you mentioned as well, there can be an addiction that forms to those medications.
And what sort of time length are we speaking of here?
Yeah, so usually it can vary per individual, but 3 months is kind of the category where we feel like this is long-term use or persistent use, and it's that point in time where if somebody's pain is continuing for longer than 3 months, then the use of these medications in terms of it being acute pain If the pain has gone on for longer than 3 months, we start to consider it more persistent pain and have to rethink how we're treating that.
Okay. Adil, you're on the front line effectively of what's being described as an epidemic of overprescribing. What does the overprescription of medication look like at an individual patient level? What have you encountered or other GPs you know encountered?
I'm in the northern suburbs of Melbourne, Preston, Baylor and Greensboro at the minute. We see this all the time. You know, there are sometimes we have, doctors that have either retired or retiring, and sometimes I inherit a lot of these patients, and it's very similar to what you just described, that they're on multiple medications, and sometimes you're trying to figure out why they're on some of these medications. And I'm often, and as a lot of doctors are, we are always trying to get patients off unnecessary medications because it's a, well, we consider it like a pill burden, you know, it's like having to remember. And then there's the wraparound effect of having to, the pharmacist on the same page, having, we have nurses that go around and deal with this as well. We have pharmacists, just, it's like a whole team approach, including the patient and their family members, trying to explain to them which medications are still important and which medications, like both of you correctly said, that maybe we could start to come off.
And Adil, what's the risk of harm to a patient who might be taking numerous medications or might be taking something like a sleeping tablet like Stilnox or a opioid like Endone for a long time?
There's no nice way to say this, but the risk is, you know, very serious, because in medication error with these kind of medications, they can play with, they can suppress our respiratory system, which means we stop breathing, and that can lead to death. So that is a very, very serious risk. I'm not saying that's happening in every single situation, but it is possible and it has happened. And that's one of the reasons these addictive substances are things that we're targeting, because of the, you know, the benefit is not outweighing the risk. We have better options nowadays that are safer, less dependent or not dependent, as opposed to things that are highly dependent.
Yeah, and I'll come to the better options. But can I ask each of you, what's the most extreme case either of you have ever seen in terms of the level and length of prescription, or in terms of the impact of these too many drugs for too long on somebody's life? Emily?
Yeah, look, I mean, when I used to work as a pharmacist, I'd certainly seen lists where people were on, I think maybe 30 plus medications was one of the longest lists I've seen. Really what I've seen is actually the benefits with deprescribing some of these medicines. And I've certainly heard stories where people had been on, say, an opioid for quite some time. And then when they actually started coming off it, they described it as a fog lifting off their brain. They felt like they could actually focus again, and they were actually less anxious and more interested in kind of, you know, doing other things that aren't medications to help support their pain.
And what does quite some time look like if you're on, I don't know, Stilnox or if you're on Endone? What's a long time that you've come across?
I think I've certainly seen people who've been on kind of these sleeping tablets, Tamiflu, for 20, 30 years, kind of sleeping tablets, taking them every single night.
Whoa. That's a long time. Adil, what about for you? What's the sort of extreme cases that come to mind?
So I'm a GP now, but I've done 10 years previously in ICU and emergency and surgery. So obviously in ICU you see the worst of the worst. And I have seen, you know, much more serious patients where this can lead to, if not death, then, you know, brain damage, you know, hypoxia, which means lack of oxygen to the brain. And then they're paralyzed, or, you know, they have some kind of long-term disability because of respiratory depression or, you know, vomiting in your sleep kind of thing.
You're listening to Radio National Hour. My guests are Associate Professor Emily Reeve and Dr. Adil Aziz. He's a Victorian GP. Joining me here on the Radio National Hour, we're talking about this new program being run by Associate Professor Emily Reeve from Monash University, a deprescribing program, helping people come off medications like opioids and sleeping pills, not necessarily because they don't have a place, but because staying on them is sometimes counterproductive, not very safe. So, Emily, let's talk about your deprescribing program. It's being billed as the first in the world. What does the new program look like?
Yeah, so there's been a huge amount of increasing evidence, guidelines, resources and tools developed both here in Australia and internationally that has given us the evidence around when we should be deprescribing these medications and developing some tools to support that. What the gap has been is actually implementing all of that knowledge into practice. And that's really what Support Meds does. So we are the first program in the world, and we are going to be deploying a nationwide network of experts that we call knowledge brokers, specifically to drive de-prescribing education at scale. And these knowledge brokers are going to act as skilled intermediaries. So they kind of bridge the gap between us as researchers and the GPs, nurses and pharmacists on the front line. So there's an education package, but the benefit of these knowledge brokers is that they'll be able to adapt it to the clinics, to the health professionals that they're there and working with, identify what may be the barriers they experience in their practice, and also identify opportunities. And then, as well as just this kind of education and working with them, we're providing some evidence-based resources, which includes things like patient-facing information, so the clinician can start the conversation, give the individual the information that they can go and take away and read, and then come back, and it can really help have that informed decision-making process to make sure it is that shared decision with the patient, family, and any other health professionals involved.
Adil, does this sound useful to you, particularly the bit about helping the health workers, have ideas about how to start the conversation?
Yeah, absolutely. So anything, any help is good help, right? Like I said at the start, this is something that involves a team. GP's problems is always time management because, you know, the way our system's set up, it's not doesn't give us the time that we need with patients. And this is where we sometimes struggle. But these are always long consults, and they always, unfortunately, we're not able to bill where we'd like to be able to spend more time with the patient. We just do it pro bono a lot of the time.
Emily, would this need to be the better options that, you know, Adil mentioned some there, but is it likely to need to be replaced in many cases by more psychosocial support, psychologists, other allied health supports? Or do you think the GPs and the nurses who are going to benefit from this program will be able to manage this transition? Is that where you're aiming it at?
Yeah, so certainly we do know that, for example, with the sleeping medicines, that there are better non-drug treatment options, as well as for opioids, some non-drug treatment options. And yeah, that will actually involve the broader allied health team, might involve physios, might involve psychologists. So our program is very much targeting GPs, pharmacists and nurses. As was highlighted, the team approach is so important, but that will then, it does also require that expanded healthcare team as well, really to make sure that pain and insomnia are being treated properly, because we don't want it to be that we're just taking away medicines. It's making sure that they're still receiving good care for their conditions.
And we're talking pain and insomnia here, so we're talking sleep medicines and opioids to a large extent. We haven't mentioned antidepressants, and the Australia Institute of Health and Welfare data in 23-24 found nearly one in five Australians are on mental health-related prescriptions. It's around 5 million people. And more than half of them remain on these drugs for longer than the intended length of time. So it's the same sort of issue. It's been labelled medicalising distress. Emily, are you looking at this class of drugs as part of your program? And if you're not, why did you make that decision?
Yeah, great question. So antidepressants, as you said, they are another area that is a focus of de-prescribing. They're not going to be one of the medication classes in our program. We worked very closely with the professional healthcare societies, as well as people with living experience of multiple medication use. There were lots of medication classes that we wanted to cover in our program. We could only cover so many. We do hope to also be able to provide guidance on those medications in the future. And in general, there is some broad information in our program around de-prescribing in general, which can be applied to essentially any medication class.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guests are Victorian GP Dr. Adil Aziz and Associate Professor Emily Reeve. We're talking about a new de-prescribing program being rolled out across the country, which Professor Emily Reeve is overseeing, to help with an issue of overprescription, particularly in older Australians. And I do just want to press again or ask again about what other supports we might be talking about. You know, as I mentioned, Adil said we have other better options. What type of change are you talking about in your deep prescription program? What, can you give us some examples of what that might look like?
Yeah, so I guess just to be clear, so we talk about supporting, providing supports for the healthcare professionals to, for them to be able to deprescribe. But I think you're interested in what we were saying before around if we're kind of deprescribing the sleeping tablet, what are we going to do instead?
Yeah, because we should say here, not all the people who are presenting who have been on these medications for a long time, not all of them are no longer needing this medication. Some of them still have the pain. Some of them still have the sleeping issues. So it's important that they're not just cut adrift, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So we do within the education program to the health professionals, we do mention these other things, and in particular we link out to there's existing other educational initiatives that support, that, you know, say how to support appropriate persistent non-cancer pain or these non-pharmacological treatments for sleeping. In particular, we know that some of these non-pharmacological treatments, in particular something called cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. Some people might have heard of CBT. This is a particular type that is CBTI, which stands for insomnia. This is actually more effective, a lot more effective than these drugs. So we certainly, with the health professionals, part of the education, we provide information about this and link out to these other resources and these other supports that are available.
Which is just ultimately going to go to the point that Adil has made, mean a requirement for more time and more psychosocial supports, more psychologists, more other allied health supports, right?
Yeah, so we do know that there are some issues getting access to these non-pharmacological supports, but we know that at the moment a lot of money in our healthcare system is going towards spending on medication-related harm. So it's $1.4 billion a year is currently being spent on medication-related hospitalizations, and a good chunk of this is preventable. So as you said, it is going to require a bit of a shift within our healthcare system, but there are real savings that can be made by deprescribing these medications, by preventing these medication-related harms, and that funding can be better spent on treatment that's actually effective and doesn't have these harms.
Well, it sounds incredibly important, and I hope it has some success. It's a world first, so congratulations on that, and good luck with the project ahead. Emily, Adil, thank you both of you for joining me.
Thank you for your time.
Associate Professor Emily Reeve is at the Centre for Medicine Use and Safety at the Monash Institute of Pharmaceutical Sciences, and she's leading this new world-first deprescribing program. And Dr. Adil Aziz is a Victorian GP and Deputy Chair of the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners in Victoria. And an important reminder after all this, that this is not medical advice. No one listening should stop taking their medication, obviously, without consulting their GP first. You're listening to the Radio National Hour. At 9 a.m. on the 1st of July 1946, a 23-kiloton nuclear weapon was dropped by the US on the Bikini Atoll in Marshall Islands. Over the course of 50 years, more than 300 nuclear bombs have been detonated in the Pacific. That's the equivalent of about 11,600 Hiroshima bombs. The last nuclear test in the Pacific was detonated by the French 30 years ago in 1996. The toxic legacy of the nuclear test remains, though, etched into the land, sea and bodies of Pacific Islanders. Many from the Marshall Islands have suffered from radiation sickness, cancers and birth defects, and the Bikini Atoll remains uninhabitable to this day. Today, a group of anti-nuclear and Pacific Island activists have descended upon Parliament House in Canberra to speak to political leaders about the harms of nuclear warfare and to demand Australia join its Pacific neighbours in signing and ratifying the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Dave Sweeney is the co-founder of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, ICAN, which won the 2017 Nobel Peace Prize for its work in advocating for this treaty. And Samuel Barton is president of the Marshall Islands Student Association at the University of the South Pacific in Fiji. Samuel and Dave, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Thanks for having us.
Good afternoon, Fran.
Dave, let me start with you. Can you just explain how the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons differs to, I think, something a lot of us will remember, which is the Non-Proliferation Treaty that Australia has signed and ratified?
Well, the Non-Proliferation Treaty predates the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, and it attempts to constrain and contain nuclear weapons. It largely accepts, in practical effect, that there's countries that have nuclear weapons. It makes a deal that says countries can have civil nuclear technology but not access nuclear weapons. It has a request and an expectation that those with nuclear weapons remove them and disarm, but that is very poorly followed through and there's very limited accountability. So the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons is an unequivocal commitment to rid the world of these weapons. We welcome the fact that they have been constrained and that there's only 9 nuclear weapon states, but we say that that's 9 too many. And we need an active policy and platform and treaty that holds those states accountable and removes those weapons from the threat that they pose to our shared planet.
And why hasn't Australia signed this treaty, the Nuclear Ban Treaty, given it is an enthusiastic supporter of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and also the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty?
Yeah, and there's much that Australia has done in weapons of mass destruction and in trying to foster international action and awareness around weapons of mass destruction and nuclear weapons. There is a stall on this one. Your question, Fran, is like, what's the major obstacle? And you could put it in a word and say it's Washington. You know, the nuclear weapon states have made it clear that they don't want any constraint on how they deploy and where they deploy and what they deploy in their nuclear weaponry. And Washington's made that very clear. So we need to, as a nation, as a sovereign nation, look at that and then say, how can we navigate this? Because we have long-standing economic, military and cultural ties with the US, and they're growing. And there are many countries that have equally important roles and relationships with the US that have said, no, we draw the line at nuclear weapons. We'd need to look at some aspects of extended nuclear deterrence in the American umbrella. We would need to ask and expect and demand that our nuclear weapons allies in the UK and the US and the AUKUS program declare and do not bring nuclear weapons into our skies, our soil or our seas. And we'd need to be very clear that we want a non-nuclear weapons defence. And other countries which are pivotal in American China containment strategy, like Thailand, like the Philippines, they've done that, Fran. They have signed and ratified the treaty. America was not happy, but they have continued to have extensive and indeed growing military arrangements across the ditch in New Zealand. The Kiwis have signed and ratified the treaty, and they remain in Five Eyes with access to sensitive and pivotal security information. So we believe that it is in Australia's interests, it is in the regional interests, it's the global interests that we take active steps to reduce nuclear tensions, which we all know are growing and real and continuing. And on this anniversary week, this is not just a historical issue, it's a present, okay, real and present threat.
Okay, I'll come back to some of those issues in a moment. But Samuel, I think it's important to hear from the people of the Pacific. Your community in the Marshall Islands understands better than most the harms that nuclear weapons can cause. Tell us how the nuclear tests affected the people of the Marshall Islands, can you?
So basically our story in the Marshall Islands starts at deception, because the U.S. deceived my people into coercing them to participate in something that they did not were not fully aware of at that time. You know, they were relocated to other atolls, and once the testings were made there on Bikini Atoll, that they told them that it was safe to go back, not knowing that there were still the consequences that lingered there. For 12 long years, the U.S. have done that. From 1946 to 1958, they did 67 nuclear tests on Bikini Atoll and Niuetuk. One of those tests called Castle Bravo was so strong that they said it's 1,000 times stronger than the ones used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And with this story of the Marshallese people, it starts at deception.
And what's the legacy of those tests over those 12 years to your community and your loved ones, Samuel?
These tests left intergenerational trauma, not only to in terms of the environmental degradation that it's taking place because of climate change, but also to our health crisis that our elderly who survived the nuclear test. It's not a coincidence because they've survived all these years and they've developed all sorts of acute radiation poisoning, cancers, particularly thyroid cancer, leukemia. And it doesn't help with the fact that it burdens us with so much issues that our environment has been affected. We cannot sustain ourselves because our land is contaminated. Right now, sits on Ruined Island is a dome.
Tell me about Ruined Island. Probably most people listening don't know about it, but it's an 18-inch concrete cap, as I understand it, that covers about 111,000 cubic yards of radioactive debris left behind by the TESS. What problems is that causing at the moment with rising sea levels and storms and climate change, effectively? What's happening?
A crack is starting to form at the dome. And while we don't have the manpower, we don't have the resources, we don't even have the knowledge to mitigate. But because of this issue, that this environmental issue that causes so devastating trauma.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guests are Samuel Barton. Samuel's president of the Marshall Islands Student Association. And Dave Sweeney is co-founder of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. And they're in Canberra on this anniversary of the first nuclear test in the Pacific to talk about Australia's global legal obligations. Dave, as you mentioned, in 2018 at the Labor Party National Conference, Anthony Albanese, who was not Prime Minister at the time, made this pledge.
Labor in government will sign and ratify the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. This resolution is Labor at our best.
So he said it, he sounded like he meant it, and he reaffirmed the commitment in 2021 and again while in government in 2023 in the first term. You're in Canberra today talking to government and non-government MPs about nuclear testing, the impacts of it, and this particular treaty. Why do you understand why Labor in government has now gone cold on ratifying this treatment, or is that what you're hearing? Have they or have they not?
Well, they haven't ratified it yet. We are very hopeful and optimistic and working hard to maintain the expectation that they will deliver on this promise. As the piece from the Prime Minister that you just played, Fran, showed, it was unequivocal, it was clear, and it was indeed Labor at its best. And so there is this gap now between rhetoric and reality. There's been time enough now to consider those issues of universality, of safeguards and verification mechanisms, and of compatibility with the Non-Proliferation Treaty and other disarmament and non-proliferation policy architecture around the world. They've had the time to do that, and now, in this time of increased urgency, where we're seeing nuclear weapons states involved in hot wars, where we're seeing some very cavalier and concerning comments about the use and the potential of use for nuclear weapons by national leaders, that it is urgent that Australia take these steps and turn that commitment into a living action that will support and sustain and protect a living world, because that's, Dave, what we're looking at.
But Dave, talk about the gap between rhetoric and reality. I mean, one of the major criticisms of this nuclear ban treaty is that it's ineffectual, effectively, if the nuclear powers who aren't party to the ban treaty or the non-proliferation treaty continue to hold and build their nuclear capacities. I mean, they've been kept pretty steady for a while now, but now China is escalating the development of its armory, and there's talk that Russia and the US will do the same. So if they're going hell for leather, and part of the Australia's reluctance in the past to not sign the ban treaty was because of that American umbrella, defence umbrella you talked about earlier, you know, why wouldn't Australia be reluctant to sign?
We need to get to the essence of this. Nuclear weapons are not a standard defensive weapon. They are weapons of mass and indiscriminate destruction. Mm. They make no distinction between children and combatants. They make no distinction between generations. They have the potential to end life on Earth. Now, that sounds melodramatic, but it's actually chillingly real assessment. And so we either accept that nuclear weapons exist and we cross our fingers, close our eyes and live in hope that people like Benjamin Netanyahu, Vladimir Putin, Donald Trump, Pyongyang will exercise restraint forever, that systems won't go wrong or collapse, that terrorism or cyber attack won't happen, or we take steps to take an attempt to address, roll back and end a weapon that humans made.
But I guess the question that is so often gets in the way of progress here is that if the nuclear powers aren't going to do it, then what point is other countries signing on to a treaty like this?
Well, the point is because we all live in a shared planet. There's only 9 nations that are nuclear powers. There are hundreds of nations in the world. We share a planet. And this treaty gives the smaller nations and the large non-nuclear nations an ability to be at the table and to say that our common future shall not be solely shaped by your perception today of your 9 states' national security. And so, like I say, you either accept that nuclear weapons are there and cross your fingers and close your eyes, or you take some steps. And we see that the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons is our best mechanism to get rid of our worst weapons, Fran. And so does half the world. Half the world's nations have signed and ratified this treaty. There is a growing move of saying to stigmatise, change the way we think about and to shrink the political space around nuclear weapons. And what we're trying to do is effectively, like, isolate the bullies. If there's 200 kids at school and 9 of them are bullies, if 191 sit around and say that behaviour is not acceptable, it changes things. There is a real politic. People say you are dreamers. This is not real politic. This is not realistic. But there is no realism or real politic in the rubble. There is no realism in closing your eyes to a threat that could end everything that's been, is, and could be into the future. And so this is a genuine attempt that the Australian Labor Party, the majority of the Australian Parliament, and clearly in every poll ever taken, the majority of the Australian people is saying, look, we should be on the right side of history, and we should be on the side of those nations, including the vast majority of the Pacific and the ASEAN region, who say these weapons have no place in a legitimate security posture.
I think a lot of Australians listening will remember well the French nuclear tests in the Pacific. They finished in 1996. That was very much due to international pressure and local pressure, and the sort of one of the low points of that was the sinking of the Rainbow Warrior back in 1985, which is such an incredible thing when you think about it. Samuel, with all that history of the United States, the UK and France testing in the Pacific, in your region, in your home region, what sort of response did you feel you got from Australian politicians today?
Based on our parliamentary meetings today and yesterday, I believe it was all positive, and I like the outcome of how we were able to discuss our issues and problems with them and create meaningful dialogues, and most importantly, talk about our stories and make sure that this issue doesn't continue further.
And do you think, Samuel, that the United States, in your case of the Marshall Islands, the UK and France, have fully reckoned with the harm and the legacy caused by nuclear testing regimes in the Pacific?
The US hasn't offered a formal apology to the Republic of the Marshall Islands. We are still waiting for accountability on the US part. We're waiting for compensations. And it's been 80 years, and I don't know how long we will be able to wait.
Dave, just finally, the world is becoming an increasingly unpredictable place. The doomsday clock sits at just 85 seconds to midnight. That's the closest it's ever been to midnight in our history. Do you have faith that the world can and will walk back from the nuclear brink?
It's a very good question, and it's a very real and present danger. I have hope in humanity. I'm heartened that 50% of the world's already signed on to this and more are lining up to sign. It's been said that there are no right hands for the wrong weapons. Nuclear weapons are the wrong weapons. They have no place in our world, and they certainly have no place in Australia. And I believe the Australian government can, will and must show the leadership and deliver on its clear commitment and sign this treaty.
Dave and Samuel, thank you very much for joining us on this anniversary.
Thank you.
Thanks for the opportunity, Fran.
Dave Sweeney is the co-founder of ICAN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, and Samuel Barton is president of the Marshall Islands Student Association at the University of South Pacific in Fiji. And they've been in Canberra lobbying for Australia to sign a nuclear ban treaty on this, the 80th anniversary of the day that the US dropped a 23-kiloton nuclear weapon on the Bikini Atoll in the Marshall Islands. And that's it from me for tonight, so thank you very much for your company. But before I go, an apology to those of you who may have tuned in for my promised and promoted interview with Israeli pollster and political scientist Dalia Scheindlin, talking about the declining support in the United States for Israel. We've rescheduled that interview for next Monday, so if that's what you're after, I'll see you on Monday. I'll be back with you the same time tomorrow. Until then, have a lovely time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.